the First Time podcast,
where we talk writing, publishing, and all of the feels.
It's conversations between us
and conversations with Australian and international authors about their craft, their books, and the writing life. I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time podcast, Season 6. This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures. We have a very special guest today. It has been a while since she has been on the show. Welcome back, Charlotte Wood.
Hello. Yay. Hi, Catherine. Okay. Nice to be seeing your faces again.
It's very delightful. We just launched straight into conversation and then, you know, almost didn't press record. Charlotte, I was having a look, and the last time we spoke to you on air for the podcast was nearly 2 years ago, as The Luminous Solution was making its way into the world. And, you know, to take you back in time, do you know what had just happened is that you were talking about the fact that you were allowed to have picnics in Sydney week. Feels like a totally different time.
How incredible. And it was freezing cold and we're all sitting in the park.
Yes.
Doesn't it just seem like, I don't know, a really other time and place even. Like, do you know what I've been reading? This is a complete aside. I've been rereading Joan London's The Golden Age, which is about the polio epidemic, about kids in a polio hospital in the 50s. And it's so interesting because I remember talking to her about that book when she was writing it, and she was saying, oh yeah, my sisters weren't allowed to go to the movies and, you know, people weren't allowed to touch each other. And I was thinking, wow, God, that must be weird. Imagine that archaic medieval time. And then, so reading this book about polio, I was like, oh, same.
Yeah, we did that. We got through it, or not quite through it. Let's fast forward.
I just had COVID for the first time.
You're kidding.
No, I was like, God damn it. It finally
got down hard?
No, actually very, very mild.
Okay. So let's fast forward to now. You released that book. You've gone on to write another one, which is out soon, which we'll talk about at the end. But what you've also been involved in is the adaptation of your novel, The Weekend, into a stage production for Belvoir. It opens next week. I'm very excited to have the opportunity to see a preview while I'm in Sydney. I'm so excited. Can you share with us, how is the pre-opening feeling different to the pre-publication feels for a novel?
Oh, it's so much better. Because look, it's not my thing. I'm just an absolutely ecstatic onlooker, really. I mean, of course, you know, I hope it goes well. I've watched the first week of rehearsals, and then I went away for did other stuff, and then I went in yesterday to just see 2 hours of rehearsals, bawled my eyes out. So it's just been magical for me. I feel really excited. I don't feel nervous. I don't feel like, oh, what if it doesn't work out? Like, none of those book-related feelings are happening to me now. Just excitement and actually complete bloody awe and admiration for the people working on this thing. It's very moving to think about what they do. Like, I've never really known what, you know, you think, oh, actors learn lines, go on stage. It's so deep and so complex and so rigorous, and they just giving it everything, like their whole self is in the moment all day, every day, rehearsals 6 days a week for, you know, 6 weeks or something. Then 4 weeks or more of shows, sometimes twice a day. It's just like blows my mind. The stamina, but also the creative, the creative energy, but the generosity. It just blows my mind. And also with Sarah, the director, the kind of technical foresight, you know, like she's really doing this really detailed breakdown of every moment, but also in her head is the whole thing, and 4-5 different actors needing different things, having different processes, and her needing to respect each of those while getting them to work together. It's flipping phenomenal.
That's fascinating. I have the most minor question. Is there a dog on stage?
Yes, there is a dog. There's a dog. And the dog is a puppet.
Oh, wow.
It is unbelievably beautiful. So it's not a kind of marionette puppet, you know. But so there's a puppeteer, a young woman called Kayla Terencio. And so she's visible the whole time, but with, you know, a dog-sized puppet that she is moving. So, you know, War Horse.
I haven't seen it. I've seen the pictures of it.
Well, I've seen like a video of it, and the people operating the horse are completely visible all the time. There's no trying to hide them even. And yet, and this is the same with the dog and Kayla. The thing is, once the puppet starts moving, she vanishes. Mm. You know, and it's so poetic and beautiful. And I did an interview about this the other day, and I said, I think the only thing that I'd be slightly worried about is that the audience won't take their eyes off the dog.
Wow.
Because he is beautiful. And even, you know, and it's a beautifully made figure, the dog's face and everything. So he's real. And the actors say, they walk around going, oh, Finny, you know, just in moments, you know, between things, not when they're acting.
That's incredible.
I'm so excited that they brought the puppetry in, because it adds a whole other element that could not be there. And especially it brings a kind of mystery and poetry and otherworldliness. So the way that Finn works in the novel, which is to kind of be a repository of all kinds of subconscious feelings for the women, but also maybe he's the ghost of Sylvie, maybe he's, you know, God, maybe he's death, maybe he's whatever. He's doing that on the stage. And, you know, once they bring in music and lighting, it's just like magical. It seems like a sort of, I don't know, mushy word, but there is an otherworldly element that's brought in because of the dog and because of this very skilled young woman operating and the people who made it, and then the working out of the movement and the kind of choreography of the play. It's just beautiful. It's so beautiful.
All that collaboration, Charlotte, the huge team that it takes. Sue Smith is the playwright and the adapter for the project. Can you tell us about what involvement, so you talked about being at rehearsals, what involvement do you have in the adaptation? What input, you know, what does it look like in practice for you?
Okay, well, so I knew Sue because we met in our Pilates class.
Oh,
as you do.
As you do.
And I kind of gradually realised that she's a really extremely modest woman. And so I didn't know for ages that she was even a writer. And our beautiful teacher said, well, now Sue's a writer too. And I was like, oh, are you? That's nice. You know, thinking, sure you are. And
how do people who are sort of top of field, like how do you divulge that? That is a strange thing.
I also did not go in there going, I am a novelist. You know, it's not like she might not have known that I was a writer either. I don't know. We didn't talk about that. But then I realized that she was the writer of You Two Are Too Young. But when I was young, Brides of Christ television series was the outstanding series. Yeah. She wrote that. She wrote Bastard Boys, Think About the Unions. She wrote Mabo. She wrote various films, screenplays, and she's written lots of plays, and I've seen two of her. So then as soon as I knew she was a writer, especially that kind of writer, we talked about writing all the time in class while we were doing our bridges and whatever.
Your teacher must be very lax to let you do that.
Our teacher is so great. And we were talking about it because she's adapted other things. She during that time, she was working on a charming Cliff George Johnson play, which I didn't see because it was staged in Brisbane. But anyway, we talked about adaptation and what was involved with it. But I think when The Natural Way things came out, I sort of jokingly said one day, why don't you do an adaptation of it? And she said, and she came back. She said, you know what? I don't think I could do that for that particular book. And I was like, fine, and, you know, whatever. But then when the weekend came out, she emailed me immediately and said, I want to adapt this. And I was like, great. How does this happen? Anyway, so then I think from memory, this all happened, you know, in the blurry days before the pandemic. So Belvoir approached my agent separately, saying they were interested in adapting it. And so then we said, great, because here's this amazing playwright and you. So then they talked and they, you know, came to an agreement. So then Sue went and wrote, and they kind of invited me to be part of the process. I pretty much said, I don't want any hands-on role, because I was over that book by then, you know, I've written it, I don't want to hang around with it anymore. I wanted to write my new thing. But also I really, really believe in creative people giving other people complete creative freedom. And so I remember years ago reading some, I can't remember what it was about, but it was, I think it was about, you know, one piece of art influencing another. And the analogy was a candle lighting another candle. So the first candle is still alight, but there's a new candle, and then that can light another. And I just said to Sue, I have no attachment to any of it. Change everything, take it apart, you know, make the dog a bird, you know, or whatever. Take it out altogether. And there have been some significant changes. But I think she trusted me to really, you know, I knew that the quality of her writing, and I just trusted her to do whatever she wanted with it. So I was just at pains to make it clear to everybody that I wanted no control, but I would love any possibility of being an observer of the process. But Sue did want me to look at the script. So years ago she sent me her first draft, which was freaking amazing. And then I sat in a table read at Belva, where they get actors who are not the actors they have now, but, you know, they employ them for a day or whatever. And they sit around a big, you know, U-shaped table and just read through it. And there's also, you know, the creative director of the company, all kinds of other people in the room. And the actors read it, and Sue. And then afterwards, and I found this just kind of like so scary to watch.
Yeah.
The kind of exposure of the writer at this moment. Because then they all sit around and go, right, so what do we think? And start, you know, then there's 10 people going, yeah, I think this bit. I mean, they were very respectful and they all said it was a great, kind of amazing draft. But this is the nature of theatre. It's collaborative. It's a collaboration. Yeah. There's no, it's my thing. It's everybody's thing. So, I mean, I felt my stomach was just in knots watching Sue's kind of, and because she, I also know her to be an extremely sensitive person, you know. So I don't know what she would say about that process, but I felt on observing that it took it out of her, you know, that sort of willingness to hear. And as I say, there wasn't any demolition going on at all, but there were kind of things that, you know, people didn't understand, or they thought it was too slow or whatever. Stuff that, you know, when you give someone, trusted person, your first draft or second draft or whatever it is that you hand over, but that's one person who you already know you really trust. This is a room full of strangers, really. So that was wild. And I think I think they asked me to talk about what, you know, the sort of stuff that you do talk about with a new book, what led to the book, how did I see the relationship, what did I think of, what was the dog's role, all that sort of stuff. So, and so that was years ago. Then they cast it. It was scheduled for, I think, 2021 or 22. Anyway, COVID, everything blew up, all the theatres shut down. So then it got bumped because of the backlog of stuff that they hadn't been able to put on. But here we are. Well, this time around my involvement has been kind of the same. So in the first week, everybody was there. Sue was there, all the actors, obviously, the director, the sound people, the costume designer, the lighting designer, the stage designer or set designer, Eamon Black, the you know, artistic director of the theatre company. So there was a lot of people in the room for, I think Eamon was only there for the first day. But then they did the same thing. The actors are so incredibly right. Like, I saw them and I'm like, oh, my God. I mean, there's something really quite spooky about people who've been in your imagination and on the, you know, and in words on a page, walking around, being alive.
Heard the actress Belinda Giblin saying that she read The Weeknd and then 2 days later she was asked to be in the play. And it seemed like a really spooky moment, along with that fact that when The Weeknd came out, so many people talked about it as stage-like or play-like, like characters walking in off a set because of the way that you set it up. So it does feel like it has these spooky, serendipitous kind of threads.
It does. I mean, Belinda is Adele. Like, there's just the... She says it herself, you know. And Tony Scanlon as Jude is just phenomenal. And Melita Jurisic, who I didn't really know of. I mean, she's been in Mad Max. She's been in, like, all kinds of amazing stuff, but I didn't know her name. She is phenomenal. They are all... And, you know, these are people with decades of experience, decades and decades of really high quality work behind them. So, and then there's Roman Dello, who plays Joe Gillespie and a couple of other like minor characters. So he's this gorgeous 20-something young man. And I kind of look at him and go, how are you coping with these like powerhouse people? And there's Kayla, the puppeteer, who's also young. And I don't know, it seems to be working unbelievably beautifully from just watching. But there was a thing in the first week that I found. So they did the table read, same thing. And then what happened for the next 3 days was something called a slow script analysis. And that was reading through the script. And, you know, when you see the script, a script, I've never known how to read a script, you know, but they're so kind of bald, you know, they're just dialogue and maybe a couple of stage directions, but really minimal. And it's like, I don't even understand how to read this. It's so fast. It's so plain. So what happened, and I believe this is sort of normal practice, although I wouldn't know, is they go through the script and mark what they've called beats. And a beat, I've always thought, oh, that's a pause, you know, but in this sense, it is any moment where there's just the slightest change of temperature or a question about whether this person means this or it's all about subtext, basically. So, and there were hundreds and hundreds of them. So, or maybe not hundreds, but maybe 100. And sometimes it'd be in one page, there might be three beats. And with every beat, there was a discussion about what's going on here? What does this mean?
Wow.
And so then each of those beats is given a name, a title. I don't have it here, but
wow.
And then the assistant director writes each of those titles on big pieces of paper and they're put on the wall on big butcher's paper. So that's like the whole play on the wall in like 60 lines or something. And so it's Sarah was saying this is about, so we all know where we are at any time, about the kind of emotional subtext of this moment, of what's going on here. So it was completely fascinating. And it made me think, wow, you know, how to maybe take that into writing fiction. I don't know, but it could be a good, you know, like second draft or after your first draft sort of thing, exercise. I'm going to try it. I don't know if I'll, you know, it's such a different animal. This collaboration versus what we do, but that would blew my mind of how complex it was. So then you see, oh, that's how they kind of expand this script from this very short, bare kind of document into, you know, it's like the iceberg, I guess. Every line has this much depth underneath it, and they're bringing all of this weight and freight to those four words after this long discussion. It was completely riveting. I just sat there with my mouth open. But also lots of discussion around the room about friendship and kind of very personal conversations, not just with the actors, but with all the production people, with me, with Sarah, the director. Like, what are your, do you have a friendship that's sort of tricky? Do you, you know, so instantly, and that was really fascinating watching the kind of strategy of opening everybody up immediately, you know, to be open, to go deep, to give of yourself. You know, it was fascinating. If I could sit in a room and watch this with any play all my life, I would be completely riveted.
I wish we could do that with novels, though, too, right? Like that halfway through, you really could do the beat sheet with a group that were deeply invested.
Yeah, I wonder how it would work, like if it would work, because you don't really want that much input, right, as a novelist.
You
need
watch it,
to
though.
Be the authority of your own. But when it's other people doing it about you, and again, it's not mine, it's Sue. It was kind of really fascinating. And seeing what they bring of their own lives and experience to my people, you know, my made up people, and changing them and finding new stuff in them. And and figuring out how to enter that person, you know, I think, yeah, especially for Judy, for example, you know, because Tony Scammon is a very nice person and Judy's a bit of a bitch. And I'm like, well, I'm Jude. So, you know, a version of me is Jude.
Yeah.
And she doesn't mean to be a bitch. She, you know, but you know, Tony was all over that. But she was also needing to find her own, like, doorway into the people, I guess.
Your novel, Charlotte, The Natural Way of Things, you mentioned that previously, it has actually been optioned for the screen. What other experiences of adaptation of your work have you had, and what have you learned from them?
Okay, for the screen, I've had, I don't know, 3 or 4 books now optioned for the screen, and so far nothing has come to pass. So what I've learned about film and optioning is...
Don't hold your breath.
Lovely, but the only thing you count on is the option renewal fee, which is, you know, whatever, anything from $100 to $1,000 or whatever. And you don't hold your breath and don't, especially because I, again, with that, I've had no, I don't want any involvement, especially don't want any involvement in film or TV. That's not to say it won't happen, but also it takes forever, you know. So there are two options happening at the moment, one for The Weeknd and one for The Natural Way of Things. And we shall, you know, watch this space, basically. But so the stage was really so thrilling because comparatively so fast to actually happen. And also that I can just be, I can go in whenever I feel like it and, you know, watch it and be part of it. Whereas film is just, you know, this huge happening internationally. It's happening, God knows where, you know, I don't know anything. I don't try to, like years ago I tried when I was young and foolish, I tried to go, okay, so what's happening with the film? So can we talk a little bit? And then it's like,
Don't send those emails.
Don't send them. Well, you know, you can send them, but you're not going to get any joy from them.
You do not get any joy.
Speaking from experience.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same for everybody. I think years ago I heard the figure of, like of all the books that get optioned, which is squillions, something like 1% get made into films. So, you know, and then you think, well, how many books get optioned? A lot, but still not most. But it's 1% of what, 10%? I don't know. So it's like, small. It's fairy dust, really. Nothing.
It's so exciting. The Weeknd, adapted by Sue Smith, directed by Sarah Goods. It's on at Belvoir Street Theatre, August 5th to September 3rd. We'll put the link in our bio. I get to go to a preview, but it's opening night. Is there a red carpet? Is there like a fancy party? What does opening night look like, Charlotte?
I don't know.
Have you got an outfit? Except,
no, but I'm allowed to take several people and they all have their outfits apparently. I will cobble something together. But so the opening night is going to be super fun. So it's an invitation only thing. So Belvoir, you know, invite whoever they want. And all the cast and people will get a few tickets. I don't know if this is because my agent is so great or what, but I get heaps of tickets. So,
that's awesome.
And I get tickets every week too. So I can also go whenever I want. And I think I get four tickets a week, which I'm basically giving to all my nephews and nieces because they can't afford the theater. And all my other, everyone else I know has already booked tickets like 6 months ago, which
isn't
is very
that
kind.
An extraordinary thing when you think about, you know, you think about when your novel comes out and all the changes you immediately wish that you had the chance to make. What an extraordinary thing it will be for you to go on different nights and see the subtle changes that might happen within the iterations of this adaptation of your work. That kind of feels like such a gift.
I know. It'll be amazing to watch what happens. And I know that there'll be little changes, and there are still script changes being made every day now. So, you know, I think I used to think, well, there's a script and the actors go and speak the words, but that is not, well, certainly with Sarah, working with Sue, but Sarah Goods is a phenomenal director. And once I knew that she was directing it, that was the other time I knew it was going to be amazing, because the best, my most loved theatre experience was seeing a play called The Children. Weirdly, I also have a book called The Children. It had nothing to do with it. At Sydney Theatre Company at the Opera House years ago, and it was directed by Sarah Goods.
Ah, interesting.
And also working with the same sound guy, Steve Francis, I think. So she's got her own posse of people that she works with. So Steve was saying yesterday this is their 12th show together. So, you know, they have a whole creative shorthand.
Mm.
They said yesterday, it's sort of like brother and sister now, you know. She said, yeah, and I kind of said, no, not like that, like that. And, you know, he doesn't get offended. But, but they, you know, they sort of read each other's creative minds a lot now. So they, so that's a beautiful thing to witness too, these kind of creative teams that are sort of all coming together into this ecosystem. It's really, like, I wish every novelist could watch this. It's just so fun.
Yeah. Well, I'm so super excited about getting to see the actual thing very soon.
I'm so glad you can see it. That's
amazing. I know. I cleared the schedule. But, Charlotte, before we let you go.
And I'm going to be seeing you, by the way.
I'm so excited. Sydney party. You've just, in between all of this, you're just quietly releasing another book this year, a novel, Stoneyard Devotional. It's out with Allen and Unwin in November, when all the big books come out, October. Can you tell us, even though you have prepped us by saying, I can't tell you anything about my book, just give us a general kind of feeling about what this book, Stoneyard Devotional, is.
All right. Now, I have not practiced how to talk about my book at all, but let me try. It is a book about a woman who sort of abandons her life in the city, her marriage, her work as an environmental activist, to go back to the place she grew up, but not to actually her hometown, but to a closed order of nuns exists on the sort of bleak plains of the Monero down south of Canberra, just north of the Snowy Mountains, which is where I grew up. And she's there sort of, she doesn't believe in God, she doesn't know what prayer is, she just sort of holes up there for a while. She goes there sort of temporarily and comes and goes, and then one day she just doesn't go back to her life. So she kind of finds herself there almost by accident, not really knowing why she's there, but she becomes part of the community and she just lives this very ritualized life there, completely ambivalently the whole time. And she's there for a while, and then three sort of visitations occur that are very disruptive to the community. One of them is a mouse plague that I could see Catherine's face about to throw up at the very thought. But another one is the years before my narrator was there. You can see why I really need to practice talking about this to get it a little more succinct. But years before my narrator was there, one of the nuns left the community, went to work in Bangkok with poor women, she disappeared and was presumed murdered. Her bones have just been found and they're being returned to the community for burial. This is also happening while COVID border restrictions are happening, so there's a lot of trouble getting the bones back. And they're eventually brought back to the community by another nun who, it turns out, is a figure from my narrator's long past. And it's scary. So that's all I can tell you.
Have you experience of nuns, Charlotte, or monasteries?
Not really, no. I visited one once for like a couple of days, but no. It's, you know, there's nothing factual about it, so I know I'm going to get a lot of, this order wouldn't, but this is a made-up order, it's a made-up place, it's a made-up, it's invented. And so I say, whatever I say goes in this order of nuns.
Thank you for sharing this, your practice pitch on us. Before you go, our listeners who have been with us for a long time will know that Charlotte used to be our agony aunt. And so I'm going to take the opportunity. That was so much fun. You can listen back. People can listen back. But I'm going to take the opportunity to ask you as agony aunt, if you don't mind. As I prepare for my book coming out next week, I'm finding the adrenaline level of both nerve, you know, terror and excitement to be very high. What's one thing that you have learned about managing that adrenaline and kind of big emotional stuff to kind of get yourself a bit grounded when you publish a new book?
Oh,
Charlotte, help,
God.
Help.
I know, Kate. Look, I feel for you, and I'm very excited about your book. And congratulations!
Thank you.
I know it's a huge, ambitious book, which I have not yet read, but I have ready to go. I honestly don't know. Except I think the older I get, the more it comes down to the body, and that adrenaline stuff is really. It takes it out of you, right? Mm. And I think it sounds so lame, but breathing and walking and or like exercising to get rid of the adrenaline so you can sleep. I have a very wobbly meditation practice, but I know that when I meditate, everything is I'm much less reactive to everything. Mm. So,
Literally just made me breathe more calmly then. So thank you.
But honestly, breathe and now I'm going to bang on about all the things I've learned from psychologists as well. But one thing a friend told me, who's a health worker, was about the audible sigh, about when you go, or, when you do chanting in yoga or singing, anything that makes your chest sort of vibrate does something to your, is it the parasympathetic, autonomic, the kind of fight or flight, fright bit of you, it calms it down. So a lot of, if you were running and doing the big audible sigh and the expulsion of breath rather than the intake of breath, so breathing and, in for three, out for five, that kind of thing. I mean, I don't know what I'm talking about here. So whoever's listening to this.
I'm lapping it up.
I'm making notes totally there.
I think it makes a lot of sense though, And I think adrenaline is the perfect way to put it too, Kate. Like you do have it really far out. Mm.
You have it and you've got to get rid of it. My strategy is I don't do dinners. I don't do going out. Like I basically do the event, go back to the hotel room, go to bed. Because it still takes 2 hours to calm down from any kind of public speaking, I think. And so then if you do the event, go out and have a great dinner, have fun, come back at 10 o'clock. It's only midnight before I can just even breathe normally. So anyway.
As Catherine knows, that is my Achilles heel.
I know it is. But, I'm 100 years older than you, and
you are not.
You have more stamina.
I don't know that I do.
Maybe.
I think it's personality. She can't help it.
Like, I can't help it. I can't.
Yeah, so just do what you want then. Ignore all of that.
No, I love it. Charlotte Wood is... It's such a joy to see you on our screen again. It's just what a joy. good luck, have so much fun, and all the things for the stage production of The Weeknd, which is out very soon, and good luck for Stoneyard Devotional as it goes out in the world
and
as well.
Good luck for the Hummingbird Effect, and I will see you at one of your events on tour.
Thank you. Mwah. We love you.
Thanks, Charlotte.
Today's featured segment is brought to you by Hachette, and I'm delighted to be speaking to Wagaya and Wemba Wemba writer Susie Anderson about her debut poetry collection, The Body Country. Susie Anderson's poetry and nonfiction writing about art, artists, memory, place, and love has been published widely in print and online. In 2018, she was runner-up in the Overland Poetry Prize and awarded the Emerging Writers Fellowship at State Library Victoria. In 2019, she was awarded a Writers Victoria Neilma Sidney Grant and was a recipient of the Overland Writers Residency. In 2020, she edited the online journal Tell Me Like You Mean It, Volume 4 for Australian Poetry and Cordite Poetry Review, and she was the 2021 Black and Right Fellowship winner. Anderson grew up in Horsham, Victoria, and is currently based on Boomerang Land. Welcome, Susie.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Congratulations on your debut collection. We were just saying before we started recording how good looking it is. It's a very beautiful collection. Can you tell us a little bit about The Body Country, Susie, and where it began?
So I won the Black and Right Poetry Prize after I had submitted twice already. So I'd been sitting on kind of a few poems from spanning about 10 years, I think, and kind of going, this feels like something I feel really ready for, like a collection to sort of, I just had been gathering for so long, I felt like. And then I was commissioned around 2019, before the pandemic, to write an essay for the Faber Academy in Sydney. They had a series of events, and Sam Twyford Moore asked me to write something for them. So I was just out of the Overland residency, where I had been writing about the sensation of having a body, and I guess as a First Nations person, how that's connected to place. And I had been living in Sydney, so I was always thinking about this distance we have from where we're from, and the way that has an impact on our mental and emotional state. And that essay came out as this really quite lyrical, like a long poem. And I was really proud of it, and I'd never really written anything like that. I'd sort of always done more shorter form poems. So I went, oh, wait a second, this could be the thread between these poems that I've been sort of trying to create a through line yet they weren't really gelling. So I looked at the essay and how it related to the poems and started moving pieces around, and that's kind of how The Body Country happened. It was like I just knew that this was the thing to tie it all together.
I love the collection. It's very beautiful. It's very resonant. We're going to get you to read something for us a little later in the interview. That was really important, I think, what you said there about the fact that you won the Black and Right Fellowship after you'd already submitted twice. And there was something that I noted in your notes at the end of the collection where you write, try, fail, try again, fail again, try again. We aren't always winners, but effort is its own reward. I think that's like such a significant piece of advice to give to any writer. What kept you going through that time, and how did you deal with those, you know, rejections or failures?
Oh, that's a really good question. And it's something that I reflected in the afterword in the collection, because I think it is really easy to get discouraged when it's sort of hard. It's very hard to make a living from writing. Not that I'm expecting to make a living from my poetry book, but it is sort of like a milestone. I think we all kind of, as writers, we tend to get attached to outcomes like prizes, outcomes like books, or even being shortlisted, you know, on a long listed, whatever it is. for the validation of others. But I think that not always did this keep me going, but definitely in when I'm at my kind of utopian ideal state, the knowledge that just by doing the act of writing, just by doing the expression to please yourself, you know, we have to do this. We like this stuff. Like, that's why we write. So I think that that's what I meant by effort is its own reward. Not that I always really feel it, but I think certainly around like the second time, I think after the second time I applied, I was like, this isn't going to be anything. But I'm really glad that I think it was the turning point of finding the essay threads to kind of knit it all together that helped me see that it did have legs. And I had sort of a quiet confidence that I had resolved something about the initial work, and that even if it hadn't won that third time, I would have been satisfied.
Great answer. Susie, can you take us back in time and tell us about your first poetry or your first writing? When, if at any time, did you know that you wanted to be a writer?
Well, I, you know, you get quite nostalgic when you think like your first book. I actually have always wanted to write. I think like going back really to when I was very young, always writing stories, always reading. You know, I loved Matilda. I wanted to be like Miss Honey, you know. Always.
So did I.
So people who, like, I always had a really good relationship with my English teachers growing up, and that's why the collection is dedicated to my teachers. And I mean also, you know, yoga teachers or people who've indirectly taught me, elders, everything. But I think the earliest things I wrote, you know, was songs in my bedroom or songs on the trampoline, like with my siblings. And I think one of them gets a mention, you know, just like yelling silly songs at the top of our lungs on the back of the ute, that kind of
thing. Was that the song with the emu egg? I wanted to ask you about that.
Emu Cross the Road, yeah.
Yes.
My oldest sibling and I like would perform that on the trampoline for mum.
I love that.
So silly. But yeah, I think we've always had a good relationship with reading and words in the home.
So from those early days of wanting that or being a songwriter and wanting to tell stories, what was your path to this kind of world of being in poetry, of applying for residencies? How did you get to there?
Yeah, I sort of took a few detours. I was always really good at English and I kind of loved writing. But in uni, I really wanted to be Miff Warhurst.
I really love that.
Specifically Miff.
Yeah.
Because she grew up in the regions and Triple J was the only radio station we got in Horsham. So I was like, I'm on a pathway to Triple J and I have to go and do media and do like kind of radio at uni. So off I went and I did manage to do like a sort of specialised couple of subjects in literature and philosophy. But being RMIT, it was sort of a bit limited. So I was sort of keeping a bit alive there. And I did an honours paper on like websites and self-publishing, which now we all think is like, we are all like, duh, self-publishing, yeah, online journals. But in 2011, it was still like the academic writing.
Yes.
So I was into these online poetry communities, which I found through blogging, because blogging kind of had helped me find community living in a regional town. But I also, around the same time, I was into VoiceWorks. I read VoiceWorks magazine and The Lifted Brow, so I was quite aware of the in-person print literary community in Melbourne. And then I applied to be on the EdCom, the editorial committee of VoiceWorks, and that really opened me up to more kind of poetry. I mean, I don't know why they accepted me. was like, I didn't do literature. I'm not really a poet, like a publisher. But I think that just speaks to the support that they give young writers. They did at the time, and I know they definitely still do, that they accepted me for my love of poetry. And then I was away, and I definitely learned so much about writing from reading what other people were submitting to the magazine, from and sort of seeing what we published and then what was close, what wasn't there. You really learn a lot about the craft. So that was honestly where I studied poetry, was at VoiceWorks.
Oh, that's such a good answer. And I know when I go into schools, I'm always talking about VoiceWorks. And when we talk to so many people, they had a start in VoiceWorks. It's just such an extraordinary support, as you say, an institution. Can you take a moment now to read to us, Susie? Can you choose a poem and tell us a little bit about it and read it to us? What a treat.
Yes. So I'm going to read you the one that I've been really vibing on this poem in the last week because, trigger warning, I'm a Collingwood fan.
No need for a trigger with me. Also oh my join God, you.
Go Pies.
Yeah, go Pies. Speed of time.
I'm really upset. Like, I was at the game on Saturday. Oh, my God, in Adelaide. I lost years off my life.
I can only imagine.
But, oh, my God, Jamie Elliott gave me a high five. Like, I'm obsessed with him.
Have you washed your hand?
Oh, well, yes. I am vaguely sane. I adore him. I adore Darcy. What a legend. Like, incredible stuff that's going on in the club. However, I realized that I have a poem that is about the 2010 grand final that was a draw between Collingwood and St Kilda. And I just was like, oh, my God, I've got to somehow get my book to Darcy Moore.
Yes. All right. We're doing it here. We are doing it. We're going to work out a way.
I'm sure it's – and Jamie, obviously. The whole club. Do you know what? They can all have coffee.
Yeah, we'll send – yeah. For the whole club. That's something that Hachette should get onto, actually. Books for the whole books for whole footy clubs.
About it.
Yeah.
Well, Tony Armstrong is on Hachette, apparently. So, and being an ex-Pie, I think there's a way.
Yeah, there's definitely a way.
So this piece is about my emotional state at the time of that grand final. And I wasn't anywhere near as into AFL as I am now, but I was into a particular guy and, I wasn't sure about it or us. And that kind of result of the first grand final that was a draw, I remember walking around the city and it was just like this strange, like people were baffled. They did not know what had happened and they did not know what would happen next. And I think that they've since scrapped the replay rule.
Yeah.
That was the last time they did it. But that's kind of the foundation of this piece, which I will now read. So accordingly, it is called 9-14-68 to 10-8-68. One of those years, the AFL grand final was a draw. It was so surreal to all the fans. It may have happened in a parallel universe. They left the stadium somber, unmoored. The city clouded over in response to the subdued crowds, even though it was early in spring. It was the same night you came to my small apartment. Still, I believe if I'd kissed you then, I could have changed everything. It feels now like it happened to another person, droves of confused faces and your voice whispering stories in my ear. Some days I look at the sky, honestly seeing it as the same one you are under. Beyond that blue, there is nothing. I protect myself from understanding that by fully loving cloud, sun, and star. It's all right there. Why anyone would go into space is literally beyond me.
Oh, I love it. Thank you, Susie. And I love the backstory for that as well. As you were reading that, I was thinking what is such a joy about the collection is that we've got these moments, these really specific moments of you know, that grand final of the emu egg, of the trampoline, of moments in particular places, and then this sense of country as well, at various times, different animals, movement through place, mm-hmm. the body. Where do you begin in your poems? What's the process for you? What comes to you first, and then what do you stretch into as you're writing?
I think it always varies. Like sometimes the inspiration is a walk I've been on and something kind of comes up from something I've seen or a memory that surfaces just from being in motion. And then other times, a few of the works are directly in response to artworks, which can often be commission, like, you know, someone will ask me to write about their work, or I've just been to a gallery and seen something that inspires me. And then I do spend a lot of time thinking about kind of place. I think specifically like around where I grew up, like Horsham, there's a few pieces about hometown, and then the farm I grew up on, which is at the foot of Garryworth, the Grampians, and then a little bit further to the north in the Wimmera, our ancestral country where the beautiful lakes are. Actually, this is like, that's a lake. If you look really closely on the cover, that's, I think it's Lake Hindmarsh, which is on Wagaya country. So yeah, it's a mix, I think.
There's some beautiful ways in which you speak about the connection between body and country in the poems themselves and in the afterword as well. Can you just talk a little bit about your philosophy around that?
Yeah, I think for lots of First Nations people, there's been a severance between their ancestral country and their culture, both or one or the other. You know, whether that's because of systematic stolen generation or child removal, all of that kind of stuff, or whether it's just because of the political kind of temperature of the time. People have various reasons for being disconnected from country. And I think for me, you know, grief has been like my father's death when I was very young. We sort of had this obscured relationship to culture. Although we had beautiful family, aunties, uncles, cousins around us, I think for me, growing into that understanding of country and culture, it had to kind of happen on my own terms in a really embodied way. And it actually did happen as I was working in Sydney and meeting a lot of beautiful First Nations artists up there, and then back in Melbourne, kind of getting closer and closer to that really grounded feeling and being on country. So I think that the body plays a really important role in that, whether you're actually physically present on country or not. And it's very important to have that self-sovereignty kind of idea of being at ease with yourself, because that way no one can take that away from you, no matter where you go around Australia, around the world. You have that kind of grounded center with you always.
It's a beautiful response. Susie, you already had that great advice about trying again. Is there some other advice that you can pass on to other writers who listen to the podcast, something that maybe has kept you going?
Oh, gosh, all I can think of is I wish I took my own advice, like in advance of whatever I say. I think really I'm a person who's very gentle with themselves. I try not to have that kind of inner critic voice who's like, oh, you should, you know, should is a really terrible word to have in your like racing mind. So I think it's just being, I'll get to the point. It's being broad with what you call writing. Mm. So sometimes writing looks like bum in the chair, we're putting down words, it's just coming out, it may not be good, whatever, but we're putting words down today. Sometimes it looks like that. Other days we're going to the library and just sort of being around words, maybe not even reading that much, but we did that, we went there. Other times it's just a walk. Like, I think that would be my other piece of advice, or other than trying again, just be persistent and also take a broad approach to the act of writing, because you're always gathering.
Mm. Oh, that's so good. And such a good reminder for anyone at any stage in their writing career as well. Susie, have you got a debut book anytime, any place that you can recommend to our listeners?
I was about to say Prep by Curtis Sittenfeld. Oh,
good one.
I just read Romantic Comedy.
And I haven't read it yet, but Catherine's read it, and she's such a massive fan.
It's like you need to take the day off work because you just want to read it all.
Okay, amazing. I'm adding to list immediately.
It's so good. And so I read that, and then I was like, well, I have to read Rodham. So I did the Rodham audiobook, which was fab. And then I went to Prep. And it's so, you just see the sort of kernels of like what she goes through in those other novels. And it's quite, you know, it's sort of like similar to musicians. Like, you don't, these days we don't always listen to the back catalogue or read the back catalogue. So it was really cool to do that with, like, and go right back to Prep, which was a bestseller at the time. And yeah, I don't know why it took me so long to get there. It's really good. I think the other one I would say is, I actually don't know. I'm pretty sure it's her debut, but the Tara June Winch novella, Swallow the Air.
Oh, my goodness.
That was her debut.
Yeah, it's that so one good.
Is stunning. And obviously, yeah, we're waiting for the next one, Tara.
Yeah. It is so good that I think my copy of it is just marked up almost on every page. You know, like it was like holding like a little jewel or something. You just think, how does she do this? Such good recommendations. Thank you so much. Susie, I'm speaking to you on the day before this book comes out. So it's a big deal and huge congratulations. But can you tell our listeners where they can find you in the next little while to help you celebrate with this beautiful book, the poetry collection, The Body Country?
Okay. So the book will be launched Wednesday, the 2nd of August at Readings in Carlton, if you're in Nam. And also I'll be doing an event later on in August at the Wheeler Centre as part of Victorian Poetry Month, which is their big gala night. So that one will be quite a fun affair.
Excellent. They are so good. We will put those both of those events in the show notes. And Susie Anderson, congratulations again on this wonderful collection. And I hope it just flies, and wish you well with all of your writing.
Thank you so much. It's been a joy, an honour to be on this pod, which I have listened to for inspiration.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.